Okay, thank you. And first of all, I'd like to thank the organisers very much indeed for the invitation to come and speak here. It's a real pleasure to be here. So as advertised, my title is set because I thought that it's now the superconductivity in strontium ruthenate has been around for about 5 years now, and it may be timely to give a kind of review of the current experimental situation to answer the question which has been coming back into people's minds again recently, which is whether the superconductivity consists of triplet or singlet pairing. That'll be the main topic of my talk. And it will be essentially a review. I'll be talking about some work from our group and work from other groups. And I'll be doing it partly as an introduction to set up the talk of Yoshi Maino, who's going to be giving more recent results from his group. He says that I'm talking about what's basically understood, and he'll be talking about some of the open questions which are arising from the most recent data. As you can see, there are many people have contributed to my part of this story. These people here are all from Birmingham University, where I currently work. The group here of Steve Julian is from Cambridge University. We have a very strong collaboration with them. And we continue to have an extremely strong collaboration with Yoshi's group in Kyoto, one of his former students, Shinichi Ikeda, who's now at ETL in Tsukuba. And in the last part of the talk, I'll shift gear and talk about something else to which Chris Fleiderer from Karlsruhe has made an important contribution. So, on the assumption that there will be quite a few people in the audience who have not thought all that much about strontium ruthenate in the past, I'll give an introduction to the basic underlying electronic structure and the sort of historical aspect of how the field developed, how the suggestion of triplet superconductivity arose. Then I'll kind of flip in time a little bit, because I'll talk about some fairly recent data which is giving out, there's a wide body of data showing you that the superconducting state is not isotropically gapped. And that becomes interesting because it makes you think about possibilities such as D-wave superconductivity rather than triplet P-wave. Then I'll move on to show that while that may be true, there are a number of pretty robust looking experiments which strongly favor triplet pairing. I think that's the main task of the talk, is to bring that across to you, to show you the depth of evidence which exists in support of the prediction of triplet superconductivity. Through none of this will I have discussed the mechanism, and I won't be discussing the mechanism explicitly at all during the talk, but I would like then to move on to show you some of the experiments that my group are currently doing with the long-term goal of giving us some more insight into the mechanism. And what we're doing is looking at other ruthenates, and in particular we're very interested in this material, strontium-3 ruthenium-207. And this turns out to be, this is a bilayer equivalent. It's like a bismuth-2212 equivalent of strontium-214. It's got a very enhanced susceptibility. It's a very interesting metal. It's not so far a superconductor, and even that absence of superconductivity may lead to some insight. And then I'll give you some conclusions. So right to the beginning, when Maino's group first reported the superconductivity of strontium ruthenate, it was thought to be interesting mainly because of the extremely close structural analogy between strontium-2 ruthenium-04 and lanthanum-2 copper-04. In fact, in a thought experiment, you can turn one compound into the other just by replacing the lanthanum by strontium and the copper by ruthenium. You get not just the same basic lattice symmetry, but you get the same lattice constants within 1% in all directions. The superconductivity was initially reported with a TC of just below 1 degree. And as we'll see, the current maximum TC is about 1.5 degrees. But this created some excitement at the time, because this was the first material with the layered perovskite structure, close structural analogs, the cuprates, which showed superconductivity at all in the absence of copper. The substitution of ruthenium for copper, or the change of the atoms, is not a benign change, though, because it leads to some extremely important differences in the electronic structure of the two materials. Notably, the idea that doping is not required. The parent compounds in the ruthenates are multiband metals, they are not martensulators, so explicit doping is not required to make metals in this system. That's very important experimentally because it means that you can get these samples of extremely high purity. Pwanong talked about a very long mean-free pass in IBCO earlier on. I'll show you presently that there are also extremely long mean-free paths in this compound. One immediate consequence of the very high purity that can be obtained is that it's possible in strontium ruthenate to do an experiment which has never really convincingly been done in the cuprates, which is to do the so-called the Hassmann-Alphen effect, or otherwise known as quantum oscillations. I won't go into all the details, we've been working on this for a long time, but this is just raw magnetization data as a function of field. Everything you're seeing here is an effect of the Landau quantization in the material, and you can see that this is a rich signal which is going to be very high in information content. When you go through all the details of analyzing this, you can study the temperature, field, and angular dependence of the signals. You can come up with an extremely accurate picture of the electronic structure and the Fermi surface of the material with resolutions which we've now been able to show are as good as 1 part in 10 to the 5 of the Brillouin zone. So we have extremely accurate knowledge of the underlying electronic state or the underlying metallic state in this material. And I'll skip through all the detail of how you get that. I'll just go straight to the bottom line. And the aspects of that bottom line which are important for today's talk are that we have a very, relatively simple electronic structure. It's very nearly two-dimensional, so a two-dimensional approximation to understand the superconductivity, for instance, seems to be a completely reasonable one. Strontium ruthenate, at low temperatures at least, is a Fermi liquid. We can show that probably beyond any doubt. It's not a trivial Fermi liquid. We have mass enhancements of up to a factor of four, a factor of four over the band mass, and bare masses of up to 15 electron masses. So this is a strongly anisotropic, practically two-dimensional Fermi liquid. It has very weak dispersion through the Brillouin zone of the three bands across the Fermi level, and we have very accurate knowledge of that dispersion. When one looks, or when particularly Rice and Seagrass saw this data, they noticed straight away that there was a quantitative link with the Landau parameters of helium-3, and this was one of several reasons that led them to make the relatively low-key suggestion that it would be sensible to think about the possibility of P-wave superconductivity in this material. And obviously that got a lot of experimentalists very interested, and it stimulated much of the research you're going to be hearing about later on today. So, if you permit me, just for a minute or two, I'll back up and make a few obvious statements about the differences and similarities between singlet and triplet superconductors. We all know about singlet S-wave superconductivity, where we have L equals 0, S equals 0, and an isotropic gap with an isotropic phase. One of the very important experimental consequences of this class of superconductivity is that if you put non-magnetic junk into the material, the elastic scattering from that non-magnetic junk can't suppress TC to zero. So S-wave superconductors are robust against impurities, which is why so many of them were discovered before we began to experimentally access the more interesting ones. If we then go from L equals 0 to L equals 2, the famous D-wave case, and I've just drawn up a D-wave gap of the dx squared minus y squared form thought to exist in the cuprates, we see that we lose this result that we are robust to elastic scattering. In fact, strong enough scattering can put TC to 0 in a D-wave superconductor. And we see that there are many other now well-known signatures in the thermodynamic properties, the Josephson effects related with these materials, all of which have allowed us to pin down the order parameter symmetry. Although D-wave is then a lot more complicated than S-wave in terms of its properties, any singlet superconductor, you can write down the order parameter in terms of a complex number. The triplet case becomes considerably richer or more complicated depending on your taste. Here we have L equals 1 and S equals 1, but the spin state is a triplet, which means you have to explicitly take into account the spin part of the pairing of each of the k plus k minus k electrons in the Cooper pair. So you go from a single complex number for your order parameter to a three-dimensional complex vector as the sort of minimal way of encapsulating the essential physics. And one of these very unfortunate things in nomenclature, this vector is called the d-vector. So the d-vector is the order parameter of a p-wave superconductor. One could spend a long time, it's a very beautiful notation, it's a very compact way of looking at these order parameters. I won't go through all that. One comment that I will just make is that in terms of the gap states, this extra richness allows a very wide variety of gap states. So if we look just in three dimensions, we could have a gap state with line nodes, with point nodes, or with no nodes at all in the p-wave state. So straight away it tells you that if you are wanting to do sensible experiments to tell whether something is a p-wave or a triplet or a singlet superconductor, thermodynamics are unlikely to be the thing, the kind of definitive experiment that you can do to get that kind of information. Oh, so the other thing I should just say, for those of you that remember helium-3 physics, this would be the A phase of helium-3 in three dimensions, and this would be the gap state of the B phase of helium-3. Now, if we go to two dimensions, which I think is the relevant way to represent what's happening in strontium ruthenate, for the efficient anodes, we can write down several of the allowed unitary states in terms of the d vectors. We can then also draw the gap structures that these would correspond to, and I've just also listed whether or not the state respects time reversal symmetry. That's going to have relevance to what I'm going to say in a minute. I don't want to go into more details at the moment, but I will just put it up on the other machine as a reference point. So that's all the kind of the blurby part. Does it have any physical reality? I mean, the prediction's a very nice prediction. It would be beautiful if it were true. How can experiment either confirm or deny this? Well, I'm not really respecting chronological order here, but one of the first striking things that I want to talk about from strontium ruthenate is that it has an extremely strong impurity effect. The superconductivity is extremely sensitive to elastic scattering. Turns out that empirically you need to make crystals with a residual resistivity of better than 1 microohm centimeter before you observe the superconductivity at all. And in the light of what I said earlier in the talk, this gives us very strong evidence that the superconductivity is at least non-S wave. It doesn't tell us anything about whether it's P or D wave or one of the other unconventional forms, but it gives us very strong evidence that it's non-S wave. So now I'll move on. I've said that thermodynamic measurements may not be the best way to do the definitive experiments to tell you whether you have a P or D wave superconductor. Of course, it doesn't mean you shouldn't do them. It's very important to know about the thermodynamics of this superconducting state. So I'll just mention a couple of the measurements that have been reported recently. And one of the notable ones, which has attracted a significant amount of attention, is the fact that the specific heat below TC appears to be linear, C upon T appears to be linear in temperature over a very wide range of temperatures. Something that's worth just pointing out in this context, though, is to say that although this linear behavior is clearly very different from the activated exponential behavior that you would expect for a completely isotropically gapped material, it's also fairly significantly different from the behavior that you would predict for one of the simple states here with a line node gap, in the sense that the linear portion exists up to really quite anomalously high temperatures. You would, for a simple line node gap, you might expect a linear behavior down at the very low temperatures. Down here, the data are somewhat uncertain and then becoming non-existent. So there are still some questions to be answered, but there's no doubt that we have a fairly striking power law coming out at us from these data. That's then consistent with, apparently, with a T cubed variation of 1 upon T1 from a ruthenium NQR study, and I know Yoshi's going to talk a little bit more about the NQR work later.
Has there been a background subtraction of Schottky anomalies or anything to get that electronic heat?
There has been a background subtraction.
So the curvature or whatever might be related to the background heat subtraction?
In principle, yes, but the group that did it is Yoshi's group, so maybe in the discussion he would be better qualified than me to tell you exactly what went on there. Yeah.
The nuclear Schottky from ruthenium is very small.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah.
What's smaller than YBCO or DISCO?
Or like UPT3.
Okay.
It's, to this temperature, it's not visible.
This is a silly point. You're plotting CE over T and you're getting a straight line. Am I giving you T squared?
Yeah, but I said CE over T was linear in T, yeah. I think I said that. Now, I should also say, I'm not going to show the data, but power laws are also being seen in ultrasound studies from Louis Taifel's group and thermal conductivity work in Kyoto. The next class of experiments sensitive to the density of states, which were, of course, extremely influential in the Cooper rates, were studies of the temperature dependence of the penetration depth, which can be done by studies at various high frequencies. At least they've been done at two different types of frequencies in strontium ruthenate. By the Illinois group, they've been done using a tunnel diode oscillator technique at 28 megahertz, and in Birmingham, some work's going on at a higher frequency of 10 gigahertz, where they get into an interesting omega tau of order 1 region. But the bottom line is that in both cases, in pure samples, they see a T squared power law in the penetration depth. So again, the overall picture is of power laws coming out of thermodynamic or density of states related measurements. In the case of the penetration depth, this may be you could possibly expect T squared behavior from a penetration depth measurement if you have a chiral or time reversal symmetry breaking superconductor. I wanted to just draw your attention to this preprint by Marinari and Segrist. But in the context of the other measurements I've talked about, the overall point is that the thermodynamics is telling you that there are power laws below TC in strontium 2 ruthenium 04. This observation of power laws combined with some, now there's very little information content on this view graph, so does, you know, it's up here mainly for decoration, but the bottom line of it is that inelastic neutron scattering work by the group of Braddon and Bourge at Saclay, in that work they were able to identify a peak in the susceptibility at about 0.6 pi, which is clearly relatable to a nesting property of the Fermi surface, but certainly the only real structure that's being seen in the susceptibility by neutron scattering is coming at finite qubits at 0.6 pi, and that combined with all these power laws that are being seen might lead you to start saying, well, the sort of zeroth order thought that I would have about strontium ruthenate, if this is all that I knew about it, would be that it would be sensible to be thinking about a D-wave pairing. That's an important point to make, so I've made it as explicitly as I possibly could. It would be tempting to do this, but the next section of the talk is discussing a very big however. It's not. If you want to make that postulate, you have to throw away a fairly wide body of evidence coming from experiments which, in my view, are more suited and more germane to the issue of triplet versus singlet specifically. And the first one of these that I'd like to discuss are two separate ways of measuring the spin susceptibility into the superconducting state. And this is well known to be a very useful probe of the issue of triplet versus singlet pairing, for the simple reason that a singlet Cooper pair is essentially a non-magnetic object. So at weak applied field, if the superconductivity beats a weak applied field, then everything pairs up into singlets, and the spin susceptibility in the superconducting state divided by the spin susceptibility in the normal state has to go to zero as T goes to zero. In a triplet superconductor, life gets a little bit more complicated because of non-trivial D vectors, but it's not always the case that this has to happen. Sometimes it is, but if you can observe it not happening, then you have pretty good evidence in favor of in favor of triplet pairing. The reason that it doesn't have to happen in a triplet superconductor is that this is, you apply a weak field, you are polarizing the Fermi surface just as you do in the case of standard Pauli susceptibility of a metal, but you don't care about that because if you're doing what's called equal spin pairing, you just equal spin pair one part of the polarized Fermi surface and equal spin pair the other part. And so in these equal spin pairs, just don't care about the existence of this field, and you would expect in that case to get the same spin susceptibility in the superconducting state as you had in the normal state. The difficulty experimentally is that Meissner diamagnetism in a superconductor gets in the way, so it's not trivial to do this kind of experiment. Traditionally, or the best known way of approaching the problem in superconductors is to look at the behavior of the night shift into the superconducting state. This can be done in high kappa superconductors such as the cuprates or strontium ruthenate. And the nice thing about being a close structural analog of the cuprates is that you could sometimes just bring out the gross differences between the behavior of the two classes of material. And back in 1990, such measurements, these measurements, this is a night shift measurement here expressed as the spin susceptibility directly, but this is a night shift measurement, showed this die-off of the susceptibility in the superconducting state to zero as T went to zero. And at the time, that was really a major nail in the coffin for anybody who was looking for a triplet solution in the cuprates. And strontium, these can be slightly controversial experiments, but it's nice to have this as a control to show you that, you know, modern NMR can give you the signal that you expect of a singlet superconductor. In strontium ruthenate, the situation is completely different. Here, I'm plotting the raw night shift straight from the paper instead of the susceptibility directly, but the kind of control is this dotted line, which is the prediction of the behavior that you would expect if strontium ruthenate was singlet. And you see that they have plenty of resolution and that this goes all the way, no change, all the way down to T equals zero. Turns out this was oxygen 17 NMR with the field applied in the ruthenium oxygen planes. The same group have now repeated this on doing ruthenium NMR, where the signal would be even bigger, and so their resolution has increased further, and they completely confirm their earlier results. Now, that, as I say though, measuring the spin susceptibility across TC by the night shift has been somewhat controversial, so it would be good to know if there were another way that you could do it. And so here I'm showing unpublished data. I'm not quite sure if it's on the net now or not, but it's from the group of Steve Hayden and John Duffy at Bristol University. They gave me the permission to show it. And here they're measuring the spin susceptibility again, but they're doing it with magnetic neutron scattering, which is another technique which was applied to superconductors such as vanadium-3 silicon back in the 1960s. There, again, in the singlet superconductor, you see the so-called Yoshida function as the spin susceptibility goes down. But here with the neutron scattering, they've got higher error bars, larger error bars because it's neutron scattering, but they certainly have the resolution to say that they confirm the result that's come from the NMR. So far this is already good, I think, to have this independent confirmation by a complementary technique. For technical reasons, it will be very difficult to imagine doing the NMR experiment with the external field applied along the C-axis perpendicular to the ruthenium-oxygen planes. In principle, the technical problems there don't apply to the neutron scattering, so the hope is that in future they'll be able to do the neutron scattering with the field in the other orientation. I don't have time to go into the details of that, but it turns out that would be a very useful thing to do to finally pin down exactly what the order parameter is. Yep.
Is there any signature of the transition in the magnetic measurement at TC?
Is there any signature of the
transition in the magnetic
measurement? No, so look, they, they, this is the spin susceptibilities. They don't see it in this because they don't expect to, but obviously both groups did. So the neutron group had AC susceptibility coil around the sample at the same time, and they certainly had no doubt, you know, there's no question that this sample went superconducting where TC is marked, if that's what you're asking.
Well, if it's a triplet superconducting, you would see perhaps some signatures.
Only if you don't have a quantum field around it, you should see something.
No, it's 2-0.
Sorry, I'll just carry on. There's another important class of experiments which have been done on strontium ruthenate. In some senses, to me, give you independent evidence that it's very likely to be P-wave, because muon spin rotation measurements done several years ago now by the group of Graham Luke and Rumura at then at Columbia showed that they see if they cool strontium ruthenate in zero applied magnetic field, they get a spontaneous onset of relaxation at TC. I haven't got the data with me to show you, but they subsequently did other experiments where they showed that this onset, this relaxation onset followed TC if you change TC by putting impurities in, for instance. This, even in the absence of the direct measurements of the spin susceptibility, I think this would be fairly persuasive, because although you can cook up or make a D plus ID state to have the time reversal symmetry breaking properties, you'd be trying to do this with two-dimensional D states, given the electronic structure of the material, and you would expect the two components of the D that you were mixing together to have different TCs. The fact that this appears to be able to follow a TC in strontium ruthenate is in some senses, it's less direct, but it's in some senses complementary evidence or independent evidence that this is very likely to be a triplet superconductor. Now again, I've heard over the years people questioning whether, you know, how reliable this experiment might be, could there be some other effect going on? Very recently, Ted Forgan's group from Birmingham have come up with what I think is quite important complementary evidence from this point of view as well. Early on, when he started to consider the effects on the vortex lattice of a superconductor which broke time reversal symmetry, Achterberg noticed that, I should backtrack here, sorry. The first key observation, or the first observation that was made when the vortex lattice was studied in strontium ruthenate, was that it is square. And you could interpret that rather naturally within a P-wave scenario, but you can also get it in other ways. But they then realized that although you could produce a square lattice within a standard Abrikosov theory by tweaking the Abrikosov parameter, so I'm showing you here such a lattice, if you do that using a standard single component Ginzburg-Landau theory, you make a fairly set prediction about the field distribution in the vortex lattice. So here red is a field maximum, blue is a field minimum. If you're forced to accept that you break time reversal symmetry, you have to do it with a two component Ginzburg-Landau theory, and although I can't give you any intuitive picture of how it works out like this, the fact is that when that calculation is done, it predicts a qualitatively different distribution of maxima to minima within that vortex lattice. And the experimental development recently is that by doing some high resolution small angle neutron scattering and making use of the higher order spots, Ted Forgan's group have been able to back transform to the field distribution and to show that qualitatively it's in pretty good agreement with the predictions of the two component Ginzburg-Landau theory. So again, this is a complementary measurement supporting the idea that we have time reversal symmetry breaking. If we're honest, we cannot claim that this signal cannot be followed to TC because the vortex lattice can't be followed to TC, but in combination with the MuSR, I think it's fairly persuasive. So that's all I intend to say for this part of the talk. It's all I intend to say about the strontium 214. Now I'd just like to spend a few minutes telling you about what we're actually doing at the moment in the group, which is to study another ruthenate and to show you that we're finding a few things we hadn't expected to see, but I believe that they're sort of independently interesting. If you take the one-layer strontium ruthenate and change it chemically to, you obviously do a new crystal growth and grow crystals of the bilayer ruthenate, so the one with ruthenium oxygen bilayers per formula unit, you produce another good metal. So strontium-3 ruthenium-207 is a very good metal as well as strontium-214. It has a residual resistivity in our best samples now as low as about 2 micro-ohm centimeters. So we're beginning to approach the levels of purity which have been possible in the single layer. It's not as anisotropic as 214, but it's pretty anisotropic, so I think that a two-dimensional approximation in thinking about its electronic structure is certainly sensible. What really catches the eye about 327 is the size of its magnetic susceptibility, just its standard bulk susceptibility. Now, I haven't had time to talk about the equivalent measurement in strontium-214, but in strontium-214 on this scale, it would be right down in the bottom. It's at least an order of magnitude higher than strontium-214. And again, naively, you would be thinking that if you've got triplet superconductivity kicking around in this kind of system, this might be exactly what you would want, something which is strongly enhanced, a strongly enhanced paramagnetic metal. Something else which is interesting, sort of parenthetically, is that you have, as you study this susceptibility, you see that it rises through a fairly sharp maximum. It then falls again, and it becomes essentially temperature independent and isotropic down below about 5 degrees. And that's telling you something about the strength of spin orbit coupling in these systems, I believe. But we became very interested, obviously, once Shinichi Ikeda had grown crystals and shown that they had these properties, because the obvious question was, if we could increase the purity, would there be superconductivity around? Now, unfortunately, to 2 micro-ohm centimeters residual resistivity, there is no superconductivity. But changing the subject quite substantially, but I hope it's interesting to this audience, what we did begin to see, what we have observed, is that this material is an itinerant, a strongly enhanced itinerant system, which is so close to ferromagnetism that it has a metamagnetic transition. And this metamagnetism is occurring, it depends on the field orientation, at either about 5 Tesla or something like 7.5 or 8 Tesla. But we began thinking about the consequences of having this class of itinerant electron metamagnetism, something like a stoner metamagnetism. And we believe that there would be scenarios that one could envisage in which this would be associated with the existence of a low temperature critical point, but quite an unusual one, which you could tune into by the application of a field. So here you'd be looking at low temperature criticality with field as a tuning parameter, and that's a strange situation because the field is already symmetry breaking. So what would this happen, and would there be any reality to this? Chris Fleiderer, we argued away about this. Chris Fleiderer and Mei Chow approached it empirically on one of the crystals that we've been using. And they produced this diagram. And I'm going to have to use chalk to explain to you, even in the slightest, what this diagram means. You have rho going as resistivity at low temperatures going as a constant plus B T to the alpha. And alpha, then, this exponent of the resistivity is related to the color scale that I'm showing you here. So blue is T squared resistivity, something like a Fermi liquid. Yellow is a T linear resistivity, very similar to, obviously, the famous linear resistivity in the cuprates. And what you see is that at low field or at high field, you cross over into a quadratic scattering rate indicative of a Fermi liquid at low temperatures. But if you do this right down above the metamagnetic field, you see that the linear behavior goes all the way down to at least down to 2.5 Kelvin, which is where the current measurements stop. So this is kind of a off-the-wall different thing I wanted to tell you about, so the stuff we're doing at the moment. This would be, Andy Millis pointed out to us, this would be an extremely interesting kind of critical fluctuation, because itinerant electron metamagnetism is a little bit like itinerant electron ferromagnetism. It would involve a spontaneous extra polarization of the Fermi surface. So these fluctuations are like fluctuations of the Fermi surface in some sense. And so this is, I think it's quite rare I'm actually not aware of previous cases where it's been able to, where we've had such a nice playground to play with these ideas and to see what the experimental consequences of them would be. So whether this has any relevance to the fact that strontium 327 has not gone superconducting yet or not, I don't know, but I wanted to just show you and show you what we're doing at the moment. I can see I was asked to go through this talk a little bit quicker than 40 minutes to give more time for discussion, so I'll skip a view graph about how we also have thermodynamic evidence for this going on. You can ask me about it if you want. I'll rush on to the conclusions. So I'll say that this is just really a summary. In terms of the superconductivity of strontium-214, we definitely have evidence that it's not simply isotropically gapped. But we also have evidence that it's a triplet superconductor and that time reversal symmetry is broken at TC. Now that's interesting because if you want to stay with a relatively simple situation and think about only unitary states in two dimensions, the only unitary state which breaks time reversal symmetry would be expected to be isotropically gapped. So quite what that's telling us, I'm not sure. It might be telling us that we need to be, or that nature has been more imaginative than sticking to the simplest case. There would be ways of going to F-wave superconductors that would be triplet, or of going to some strange non-unitary states within P-wave superconductors where you could preserve the coexistence of nodes with time reversal symmetry breaking. Maybe that's what we need to do. The more mundane thing, though, is that although the electronic structure is simple, it's not trivial. There are three Fermi surface sheets, and Morris Rice and Manfred Siegrist and Achterberg have already pointed out that this means that the superconducting coupling between these sheets could come on fairly gradually, and it could lead to complications. And it might be that the thermodynamics is sort of fooling us into thinking that line nodes are the most likely thing. I think that maybe Louis Typhoon may have something to say about this afterwards. So that's definitely an open question. Strontium 327 is a strongly enhanced paramagnet. It's an extremely interesting metal, and you know, watch this space for what happens when we manage to increase the purity further. And we hope that what we're doing on strontium 327 will eventually give us some insight into, you know, one of the main open questions, which is how do we understand in detail the mechanism of what's happening in strontium 214. One of the great things about it is that its electronic structure is known well enough that, you know, this is something that ought to be understandable. We ought to be able to do explicit calculations of exactly why the superconductivity is happening as it is. So that's the task that I set to the audience, and with that I'll stop, and thanks for your attention.
Well, thank you very much for giving us some time for discussion. Open for discussion, yes.
Can I ask more about the analogy with the Kupre? Are these very liquids in the normal state?
The ruthenates are... There's extremely strong evidence that the strontium 214, the superconducting ruthenate, is a Fermi liquid below a temperature of a few degrees. The characteristic temperature is quite low, but it's a Fermi liquid, yeah.
And what about the superfluid density in the plane? Is that the same sort of number that we get
from copper oxide? The penetration depth is of the order of, yeah, it's not so different. I mean, it's of the order of 1,500 degrees or something. 1,500, 2,000 angstroms, pardon me.
Okay.
Yes,
I can follow up with that question. What happens at higher temperature when they ruthenate?
Okay, yeah. So,
is there any understanding of it? Okay.
Can you hear
that? So what I've just been asked is, what happens at higher temperatures? I mean, one of the big interesting issues that I just didn't have the chance to touch on at all in ruthenate physics is how do you understand the scale at which you, in detail at least, at which you lose the Fermi liquid behavior? That depends, how well that's understood depends to a certain extent on who's telling you, and some people would believe that it's understood fairly well. I'm not so convinced. But at higher temperatures, there's no doubt that many of the properties of strontium ruthenate look pretty similar to the properties of cuprates.
Okay.
And
but it goes like a spin one, global spin.
In the susceptibility, it looks like just a simple Pauli fan magnet up to fairly high temperature.
Very different from the
Ruthenium 207. That's right. Certainly.
Yes.
Andy, can you put up this slide here with the yellow critical regime in it?
Yep.
I'm just confused about what the facts are. At zero temperature, there is a phase transition which is ferromagnetic, it's metamagnetic in nature.
That's right.
Is it known exactly what happens to the Fermi surface when this occurs?
Absolutely not yet, and that is something that we ought to be able to access experimentally, and it's something that we really want to look at.
You showed the Hasman-Alfin.
No, the Hasman-Alfin was all from the other compound. Actually, the search for the Hasman-Alfin signal in this compound is going on at the moment. But it's also, the purity issue is still a real one. I think if we were ever, what you would ideally want to do would be explicitly to find out the Fermi surface below and above the metamagnetic transition. At the current levels of purity, I think it's likely that we will be able to find out what the Fermi surface is at high fields, but it's unlikely that we'll be able to trace it to low field. We'd have to get much purer than we currently are to do that.
Yes. With respect to the parent mechanism, you said that in the neutron scattering experiments you found this peak, which is incommensurate at somewhere 2 pi over 3 to pi over 3.
Yeah.
And I think one of the problems is actually that you have three different Fermi sheets, and the question is it possible with some miraculous experimental trick to actually take apart what contribution comes from what kind of sheets? There's this alpha and the beta sheet, which probably are hybridized, and then there's this gamma sheet. Is there any way how one can take these contributions to magnetic susceptibility apart?
Well, one can certainly associate the peak that's been seen with nesting which occurs on the alpha and beta sheets,
right?
So that, you know, because it's one of the advantages of knowing the Fermi surface well, that nesting vector is quite well predictable from calculations which then agree with the experimental Fermi surface. So in that sense you can, and in that sense, I should have tried to mention that means that it may mean that it's not even all that relevant to the underlying mechanism, because many people would believe that the driving force for the superconductivity is related to the gamma sheet, and very little is known experimentally about the susceptibility that corresponds to the gamma sheet, although some calculations have been done.
It's a question of range of temperatures, you see, is changing the exponents from the beam to the square. Is it more than the decay of temperatures?
That's 12K and that's 2.5K. Having said, although at the zero field we have lower temperature data, so the T squared behavior goes down to well below 1 degree, so it's over a decade of temperature there. And there, well, it's as you see it. Let me just show you the resistivity, at least in zero field. It's complicated by the fact that where the susceptibility in the 327, where the susceptibility has a pronounced maximum, you see some signal of that in the scattering. But then it's a fairly linear resistivity, much higher.
The susceptibility goes like almost 1 over T-like.
The susceptibility goes almost 1 over T-like, and it's corresponding
like
to... If you do the fit there over a restricted temperature range between, say, 200 and 300 degrees, you get a reasonable fit, and you would get a moment out of about spin 1.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, two more.
I want to bring up something that may be evidence of singlet tunneling also. Can I show one view graph?
Sure.
Easier to do it. We've been trying to do Josephson tunneling in the anticipation of trying to do corner split experiments, try to determine the symmetry. We haven't been able to do that yet, but what we have done is actually observe very large supercurrents in this material. This is from conventional superconductor, in this case, indium. These current densities are very large. They're comparable to what we see in the cuprates. And as you may be aware, when you have tunneling from an S-wave to a P-wave superconductor, this Josephson tunneling should be greatly suppressed. due to the parity mismatch. As an example, we've looked at heavy fermion tunneling for a long time and never seen any supercurrents in that material. So this seems to suggest to us, without having actually done a phase sensitive measurement yet, this may indeed be a singlet material because of the size of the supercurrents. I should say we haven't done the experiments because the diffraction patterns show a lot of irreproducibility. It could be due to flux motion. It may also be due to some kind of domain formation that would be suggestive of unconventional or complex order granules. So this is pretty preliminary, but I think the size of supercurrents really surprised us.
Okay.
That could quite easily
go. Interested to discuss that with you afterwards.
Yeah, maybe I should just mention the whole business of identifying the order parameter is really unsolved. I think specifically the law and the NMR relaxation rate. I thought certainly to me really suggested that there should be line nodes like in UPT. And we went looking for those with ultrasound attenuation, which is very sensitive to node locations. The striking thing there is that we see power laws, but practically no anisotropy when we go around in the plane. So the plot thickness is, you know, what is this order graph? That's not quite solved.
Yeah, so if I could just make a general comment responding to both of those comments. I mean, fine. What I think, though, is that the separate pieces of evidence which can only easily be understood in the background of triplet superconductivity seem now to me to be fairly strong. People can draw their own opinions, but in my view they're fairly strong. And so it might be that we want to understand some of the mysteries, at least try to see if we can find ways of understanding those mysteries, but from that framework it seems to be the most sensible way to go.
Okay, thank you very much again. And we'll be